I've entitled today, His Presence Demands Faith. His Presence Demands Faith. We're busy with a series on the presence of God. And today I want to take that just a little further and help us and challenge us in our thinking in terms of this. I'm going to be going through a story that I would doubt that there's anyone in this room that has not heard a preach on it. And for many of you, you've actually preached a message on this, is Jesus asleep in the boat. And so when I was preparing, I'll be honest and say there's sometimes when Jesus says, I want you to go to that story, and I have the temptation to say, oh, please, Jesus, don't make me go there. Because everyone has heard a million preachers on it, and they've all heard really, really good stuff. And the challenge is then to try and bring something new or fresh. And I felt as though the Lord said, this is a season of my presence. It's not a season of good theology or trying to impress with good preaching. It's to call out for the presence of God. And so that's one of the reasons why I want to go there. When I read the story, I identify with the story. And my story was many years ago. I was a little guy, and my dad had a friend who had a boat. And when I say boat, it's perhaps a huge exaggeration. It's probably what we would call a tinny, but it had a steering wheel. So a tinny with a steering wheel. Can you imagine? You know, It really, we're talking about something that is just miraculous to stay afloat. And there were three of us that went out, my dad and his mate and myself. And we went out fishing on this very, very big lake. And so we headed out on the lake and we're fishing. And while we were fishing, they were pushing it later and later. No, 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 this is going really well. Come on, let's just hang in a bit. Let's just hang in a bit. But it was starting to get dark. And at that point, they then said we should probably head back. And suddenly, wind came up, and it started to howl. It was within literally a half an hour, the wind was pumping. And we started to head back for where we thought was the place we had launched from. But they had no idea. And the waves had started to build. And I remember hiding behind the two seats as they were thumping through the water. And waves were just breaking over the top of this boat. And I remember kneeling at the back as we were just thumping through the water and watching the water fill up inside this boat and thinking, that doesn't look like a great thing. I have an idea that that water should be outside and not inside the boat. And what happened was that they kept, between my dad and his mate, they would say, I think it's there. And we would head off and we would land up in kind of a seaweed stuff that it was growing in the water. And it would get tangled in the propeller and they would have the motor up and they would be trying to clear the motor and then kind of paddle out again and then we'd take off. And this just happened over and over and over. Well, within 10, 15 minutes, we were absolutely drenched. But this was not going well. It was really, really not going well. And I remember us arriving at some ungodly hour in the night. And as we launched the boat on the beach, I remember my mom being there. And I don't know what happened between her and my dad. They didn't do it in front of me, but I don't think it was healthy somehow. I remember my mom holding me. And me thinking, I'm really glad that she's holding me because it was kind of my first near-death experience. And for her, I think it was one of those where I don't know where you've been, but I kind of feel like I'm really glad to have you back moments, you know. And but it was not pretty. And I'd love to tell you that there was a great story that came out of it. There was no great story. It was just one of those traumatic experiences you have as a kid. And I think if it was modern day, you know, if it would happen today, they would have probably put me in counseling for kind of 6 months. And, you know, I would have had some disorder and whatever. But in those days, it was just like a grow up, get over it. Let's go to sleep and you'll be fine in the morning stuff. But that was my experience. So when I read the story about them in the boat and the storm, it was pretty hectic. I'm really glad we're having breaking of bread today, because I've been on that lake, and we had breaking of bread on that lake. We were on a boat, and as we were crossing the lake, I remember them giving the safety instructions as we left, saying, listen, this is, I mean, it was like glass. It was literally like glass. And me thinking, this is incredible, what a beautiful day, Lake Galilee, and we're crossing Lake Galilee and we're going to break bread on the boat. And we launched out and the skipper gave instructions, this is where the life vests are. And I'm thinking, are you serious? We need life vests on the glassy lake, you know, it's just like this stupid. And then he said, on this lake, and he's a Palestinian man, he said, on this lake, the wind can come up literally within 10 minutes, and if we see the slightest indication of that, we're heading back for sure, because if we wait any longer, we won't make it. And I remember thinking, that's the story. That gives context to the story. And I remember us getting back, and there was a car park along the side of the lake, and there's signs in the car park that say parking here under severe weather conditions could result in your car being swamped, you know, some kind of language like that. And I was just like, really, the glass lake is going to come and swamp your car here? I mean, like, unbelievable. But that kind of gives context for me to the story we're about to read. And so I want to ask you if you would turn to Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8, and let's read the story, and then we're going to go through a couple of things. And it's a really short story. I mean, we're talking about kind of 4 verses, and we'll unpack the verses in just a little while. Luke chapter 8. And if you don't have your Bible with you, it's on the screen. And follow with, if you would. One day, Jesus said to his disciples, let us go over to the other side of the lake. So they got into a boat and set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake, so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we're going to drown. And he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided, and all was calm. Verse 25, where is your faith? He asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. Interesting is that the readers who are reading this have a bigger picture. And so for us, as we're reading the story, our minds might go back to the book of Daniel, where Daniel speaks about the sea and how dangerous the sea is and how sea creatures come out of the sea, these monsters of the evil world. We might think of Jonah and think about Jonah, who was not as fortunate as the disciples were on that day in Galilee. And they faced the raging storm, and he was thrown overboard at his own suggestion. We might think about the Israelites and how that they left Egypt and they get to the Red Sea and stand at the Red Sea and are absolutely cornered, can't go anywhere. And Moses has to lift his rod, and that opens up this Red Sea. Or we might go back as far as creation and think of what happened at creation, where it was a sea that was in absolute disarray, and God then starts to create and create order out of all that's there. The disciples would have known some of those stories too. The disciples also would have been well-versed in the Psalms. And so in the Psalms, and that's a slide that'll come up, you don't need to turn there, but just follow with me, they would have known who stills the sea. Because Psalm 65 verse 7 says, identifies God as the one who stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves. Psalm 89 verse 9, the psalmist describes this praise to Yahweh. You rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. They would have known Psalm 93 verse 4, which asserts, mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty. They would have known Psalm 107, which claims of Yahweh, he made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. But let's go back to that story. And I want to ask if that scripture can go back up again of Luke chapter 8. And let's start to look at those verses. The first verse is the one that grabs me most. And it says, on one day, Jesus said to his disciples, let us go over to the other side of the lake. And so they got into a boat and set out. And when I read that, I wondered, did Jesus not know that there was going to be a storm? If Jesus knew all things, and Jesus knew what was coming, Jesus knew that there was going to be a storm, and yet he says, let's go to the other side of the lake. Why didn't he wait? If he knew that there was going to be a storm, why didn't he say, listen guys, it's going to be a hectic storm tonight, but let's wait here until tomorrow, and then we'll head to the other side of the lake. I think that Jesus had something in mind. I think that Jesus had the lake now. And unless we do the lake now, we're not going to learn the lesson that needs to be learned. You see, not every instruction we have leads to perfect peace. Not every instruction makes it easy. I read the story this week about Joseph, and most of you know the story about Joseph, how that Joseph is betrayed by his brothers, is thrown in a pit, he ends up in Egypt, he's there busy and spends time in the prison, then spends time with Potiphar, then eventually becomes governor, then he starts to store grain, and then his brothers arrive and he says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And as I read that story, I thought, I would never have done that. I don't know why God was so ill. Was he not thinking when he did that? You see, for me, I would have done it completely differently if I was God. Sometimes we all think we should be God because we know a better way to do these things. What I would have done is sat Joseph down and said, now, Joseph, you need to learn a bit of humility. Stop your rubbish and start acting appropriately. Do not antagonize your brothers. You need to go and apologize to them. And if you apologize to them, you're going to learn a good lesson. Now, I'm going to make you king. We're going to transport you tomorrow by camel. And then we're going to skip a whole heap of chapters here because I don't think you need to go to prison. What you need to learn is to be dependent on me. Do you understand this, Joseph? Yes, you're good to go, son. In a week's time, I'm going to make you the governor. And then we're going to have a whole lot of grain and you're going to be able to help your brothers. I would have just shortcut the process. Surely it would have been easy. Wouldn't it have? You're looking at me and saying, heresy! We can't believe. No, no, no. That's the life we all want to lead. We want that life. We want to skip the pit. We want to skip the sold into slavery. We want to skip the prison. We want to skip being antagonized by Potiphar's wife. We want to skip the whole thing of being forgotten about. And we want to fast forward through all of that, and we want to get to the other side. In the same way, these guys are thinking, are you kidding? You knew this was going to happen. Surely you could have waited until the morning. But I think Jesus has something in mind. Verse 23, as they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped and they were in great danger. And the question that was left in my mind is, does God sleep while he's present? Does God sleep while he's present? Because sometimes it feels like that. How many of you have prayed and felt like, I'm sure God's having a snooze in the middle of my prayer. Like he's just not doing exactly what I want him to do. What on earth is going on here? Is God having a little snooze while I go through my crisis? Jesus is there, but he's asleep. And I think that we best be prayed up before the time comes for a prayer meeting. You know what I mean by that? Is that when we hit the storm, is often we're wanting to call for the prayer meeting. Oh God, now I need to pray. And I'll be honest and say, when the storm comes and is raging and I'm busy scooping water out of the boat, the prayer that usually comes to mind is, oh God, help me. We had a friend, and I've told you about him often, who was my spiritual father. And he would say, he said, you need to build up your antibodies. He said, you need to build up your antibodies. You can't wait until you're sick and then start praying. He said, that's never going to work. Never going to work. He said, you need to build up your antibodies in prayer. He said, pray every day, pray every day, pray every day. When you get sick, he said, you're going to be laid low. You're not going to be able to pray. This week, Kevin and I went to go and meet with a businessman that I have good contact with. And he does a whole heap of work in terms of wellness. And Kevin and I were busy sitting and chatting to him. And he said a very interesting thing. He said, if you ask people, what are you doing about your physical fitness? In other words, your physical state, what are you doing? He said they would be able to tell you exactly what they are doing or should be doing. They'll tell you we're eating right, we're exercising, and we're busy, you know, we're doing gym, we're doing all the right things. We know what we should be doing. But he said if you ask them what are you doing about your mental health, he said people don't know. He said, what they'll do is they'll tell you what they do when they hit the wall. In other words, when I hit the wall and I hit a panic attack, then I take this medication. Or when I'm totally stressed, this is what I do. But he said, they can't tell you what they do in the same realm as the physical realm is to be able to do that. And as he sat and told the story, I thought, yeah, he's absolutely right. Because I'll be honest and say, I don't have a huge grasp on all that I do in terms of my mental health. But I thought there's a third dimension to this, and that's the spirit realm. And what are we doing in our spirit life is before the storm breaks? What is it that we're busy doing is to build a resilience in the spirit realm so that I'm not crying when the storm breaks. Oh God, where are you? Or going to wake him up and saying, we're about to drown. And so I want to encourage that we think about that. Verse 24, it says, the disciples went and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we're going to drown. And he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters, and the storm subsided, and all was calm. And for me, the thing that struck me as I was reading the story, because I felt like God took me to the story and said, I want to show you something about my presence. And I said, God, what is it that is in the story? And he said, you see, there's an active presence and there's a passive presence. And the passive presence is that I'm in the boat always. I'm always there. I might be sleeping or I might be awake, but I'm always in the boat. But the active presence is when I get up and I rebuke the storm. And I said, help me through my thinking on that. And I felt as though God took me through and said, you see, authority is something that we are all given. But power comes out of our mouth. Can I say that again? Authority is something we are all given. Power comes out of our mouths. And so for all of us, we have authority. For those disciples, they had the authority in that boat. But what they needed to do was to have the power expressed out of their mouths. But instead, they were depending on the presence of God, the latent or the presence that was always there, rather than saying, oh God, we need your presence. your active presence right now. Then, verse 25, it says, "Where is your faith?" he asked the disciples, and in fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him." And for years and years, for thousands of years, theologians have wrestled with this thing. Why was Jesus so harsh that he turned to his disciples and said, "Where is your faith?" Why was he so harsh? And for many, they've struggled with that thing. Well, I prayed and Jesus gave me the answer. I'm talking nonsense. Well, here's my guess at what happened. You see, I think that Jesus was saying, first of all, is I've given you authority, and I want you to use it. I want you to exercise it. And then when it doesn't work, I want you to come and sit with me and say, I used my authority, it didn't work, I'm going to need you. In other words, is storm, in his name, stop it. In his name, storm, stop it. Stop it, storm. Oh, it's not working, can you tell? You see, when we're thinking we're going to die, we've left it too late. And often we're going to wait until the point of death. In other words, the storm has set in and we're thinking we're going to die before we call on his name. And sometimes the last thing we think of doing is prayer rather than the first thing. The other thing that strikes me is that I wonder if they were mates. In other words, is that there was this understanding of this is Jesus and Jesus is our mate. He's one of our mates. He's just like us, except that he's the Messiah. But he's our mate. And so instead of recognizing and saying, hold on a moment, this is the God who it speaks about in Psalms, who silences the storm, we were mates. And I think for us very often it can become, Jesus is so familiar to us, is that in our familiarity, he becomes our mate rather than our God. And sometimes there's this presence that we have to recognize, that it's a presence that drives us to our knees, that says, I'm thankful that you're my brother, but you're not my mate. I'm grateful that you're God eternal and you have authority over all. Why was he so harsh? And perhaps it was that Jesus was saying, you know what? You're on a boat, and we're going to be safe, but I'm about to face a boat that I can't get off, and I can't rebuke the storm, and that boat is going to sink. And my Father will turn his face away and will abandon me, unlike what I'm doing with you. You see, I will never abandon you, but I will be abandoned so that you will never be abandoned again. And I think that there was something in Jesus that was saying, I've told you over and over and over and over and over again what is to come. And that which is to come is that I will be sunk so that you never have to sink again. Could I make 3 points as a summary? First of all, is that presence does not permit presumption. Can I say that again? Number one, presence does not permit presumption. In other words, is we cannot do what we want to and then ask God to bless it. We cannot go on the lake we want to go on and face the storm we think we should face and then ask God to bless that. For us, we are going to have to understand that we cannot be presumptuous. For the disciples, they understood that. And the disciples said, but he gave us a word, and he said, go over to the other side. And on the basis of that word, I'm going to hold on to the word. The word was very clear. Let us go over to the other side. In other words, Jesus has given express permission and he's given an absolute instruction, and we're going to walk in it. And for us, we cannot be presumptuous and then call on that presence. We're going to have to be very clear and being led by the Spirit of God. Number two, the presence does not guarantee easy living. The presence does not guarantee easy living. Most of you know that I work at a school, and I went to, I don't often use the toilet block down at the primary school where the staff go, but I was down for a meeting, and I'd gone into the bathrooms, and on the door in the bathroom, they had stuck a whole heap of pictures, and the pictures were all, come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden. They were great scriptures. They're just so encouraging. But I'm busy preparing for this preach. And so, of course, when you're preparing for a preach, you see everything through those eyes. And so when I looked at those scriptures, I thought, how great are these scriptures? They're so encouraging. But every one of them, guess what the pictures were? A beautiful, quiet lake. A lovely mountain with a bit of snow on the top. There were some of beautiful orange trees in autumn as the leaves were turning orange. They were lovely. It was just beautiful. I want to tell you, it's at those times that those scriptures are not greatly helpful. It's the time when the storm is breaking and I'm thinking, oh God, I'm going to die. That's when I need it. I thought, let's change the pictures. The pictures should be of storms where the ship is busy rocking and going crazy. It should be where the airplane is busy shaking and is about to hit the ground. It should be where things are going horribly, horribly wrong. And we should have those scriptures. But you see, I think for all of us, there's something of we want the nice. You see, when I want the peace of God. When I think about the presence of God, what do I think about? I'll be honest and say, when I think about the presence of God, I think about the lake.
That's so true.
I think about the mountains. I think about being in the vineyards when they're all green and there's grapes on the vines. I do. I don't think about the presence of God where there's a storm busy going on. That's not what I want. That's not what I'm praying for. But it seems as though Jesus might have had that in mind when he said we have something to learn. Number three, presence demands a transfer of fear. Presence demands a transfer of fear. You see, in that last verse, when I read it, the thing that jumped out at me was that the disciples were in great fear. They go and wake Jesus up. Jesus rebukes the storm and says, why did you not have faith? And then what does it say? And they were in great fear. And I thought, no. I'm sure it's a mistranslation. What they should be saying is, then they were in great peace. But they weren't. But what had happened was they had transferred their fear from a fear of that which they could see and hear and were about to be overcome by. They transferred fear to an awesome reverence of a God who's able to calm that storm. And I want to say for us friends, part of the presence of God is when the presence of God breaks into our storm is that we're going to need to learn to transfer our fear. In other words, is that we're not fear of the things that we see and hear, but that we're fearful of this very God and in awe and reverence of what he brings in every part of our lives. While I was preparing, I came across John Bloom, who I often read. And John Bloom had written a part on this, and I was going to tell the story, and then I thought I would be doing John a huge disservice. And so I actually want to read it to you if I can. And so he writes the story. Could I read to you? He says, the sea was quiet now. He's imagining what it's like afterwards. So he's saying, listen, after the storm was quietened, he said, well, what does it look like? What happened? They don't tell us, but he said, here's what I imagine. This is what he says. The sea was quiet now, and there was just a breeze enough to push the boat along. The disciples were quiet too. Andrew was steering. He had taken over from Peter, who sat wrapped in a cloak, exhausted and lost in thought. He'd been soaked to the skin, and others were bailing out the remaining water. And Jesus was asleep again. I love that. Jesus has gone back to sleep. James leaned on the bow gunwale, watching reflections dance on the benign waves, and he was trying to absorb what he had just seen. James knew the sea. He and John had spent most of their lives on or in it. His father was a fisherman, and so were most of his male kin and friends. His mind flashed the faces of some of them who had drowned in unpredictable Galilean windstorms, like the one that had pummeled them barely a half hour ago. A seasoned boatsman, James was not alarmed easily, but he knew a man-eater when he saw it. The storm had opened its mouth to swallow them into the abyss. Terror had been in John's eyes when he grabbed James and yelled, "We have to tell the master," and they stumbled to the stern. How Jesus had remained sleeping while the angry surf tossed the boat around was itself a wonder, and they woke him screaming, "Save us, Lord, we're perishing." And James would never forget the way Jesus looked at him. His eyes were at once potent and tranquil and not a trace of fear. Laying aside the blanket, Jesus rose to full height on the rear deck. James, fearing Jesus was about to be pitched overboard, reached to grab him as Jesus shouted, "Peace, be still." No sooner had those words left his mouth than the wind was completely gone. The sudden hush of the howling was otherworldly. The waves immediately began to abate. Each disciple stood where he was, looking dumbfounded at the water and sky and each other. Jesus' gaze lingered for a moment on the steep hills along the western shore, and then he looked around at the 12 and said, "Where is your faith?" He had looked right at James when he said faith. Now, as James leaned on the bow, he turned to Jesus' question over and over in his mind, "Where is your faith?" When Jesus first said it, James felt its intended rebuke. Didn't he trust God? Wasn't the Father with Jesus? He had thought he believed this, but the storm proved that all the confidence he felt when the pressure was off was fair weather faith. The Galilean westerlies had swept it away. He felt chastened and humbled. But the more James thought about the question, the more profound it became. Where is your faith? Where is it, James? When the storm hit, what did you trust? I trusted what my eyes saw. I trusted what my skin felt. I trusted the violent force that was tossing the boat like a toy and would have rolled us over any minute. I trusted the stories told by my father. I trusted the tragedies I remembered. I trusted the power of the storm because storms kill people. Up until a few minutes before, this would have merely seemed like a common sense. But Jesus had changed everything. As James looked back to the sleeping Jesus, the psalmist's words came to mind. "For I know that the Lord is great and that the Lord is above all gods. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does, in heaven and on earth, in the seas and all the deeps. He it is who makes the clouds rise at the end of the earth, who makes lightnings for the rain and brings forth the winds from his storehouses. Who then is this? Someone who can command a killer storm to die when he pleases?" Holy fear washed over him again. However, this fear didn't produce panic, but deep, unnerving, reverent joy. And the part that grabbed me in that story is, but Jesus had changed everything. You see, I want to say to you, friends, we can know Jesus or we can know Jesus. Jesus can be in our boat for all of our lives, but we'll only know him in the storm as the one who gets up and rebukes the storm. And the presence of God is something that we can know his presence or we can know his presence. And when I speak about us knowing the presence of God, my challenge is that in the midst of the storm, we identify and come to know his presence. Let me close with a story of John Newton, and then after that we're going to break bread. The story comes from the 1780s, and most of you know the story about John Newton, who was actively involved in the abolition of the slave trade. He himself had been a slave trader, and there's a long story. Most of you know the story about John Newton. The story goes about him walking the docks of Deptford, South London port on the Thames River. And now he was a pastor many years later, and a very unlikely pastor at that. And it speaks about him walking on the docks, and he watched the celebration in the dockyards as a really wonderful ship was majestically launched back into the water of the Thames. And he pens a letter to his adopted daughter, and I had not known about his adopted daughter, but a very interesting story. And they had adopted a daughter who was at boarding school, and he writes to her, 13 years old, and this is the letter he writes. He's speaking about this ship that was slipping back into the Thames. And he says, "She slipped easily into the water. The people on board shouted, and the ship looked clean and gay. She was fresh painted and her colors flying," he recounted. "The ship was beautiful, but I looked at her with a sort of pity. Poor ship, I thought. You are now in port and in safety, but ere long you must go to sea. Who can tell what storms you may meet with hereafter, and to what hazards you may be exposed, how weather-beaten you may be before you return to port again, or whether you may return at all." "A safe harbor, Betsy," was his daughter's name, "but by and by you must launch out into the world, which may well be compared to a tempestuous sea. I could even now almost weep at the resemblance, but I take courage. My hopes are greater than my fears. I know there is an infallible pilot who has the winds and the waves at his command," Newton wrote. "There is hardly a day passes in which I do not entreat him to take charge of you. Under his care, I know you will be safe. He can guide you, unhurt, amidst the storms and rocks and dangers by which you must otherwise suffer, and bring you at last to the haven of eternal rest." And as I read that story, I thought, John Newton knew it. Because John Newton himself had been a sailor and had been a trader and had ridden the hard seas. But he had come to know on the hard seas the infallible pilot. And I want to tell you, friends, that whatever we're busy facing, whether it be something physical, whether it be something in our mental health, whether it be something in our marriages, whether it be something in our finances, whether it be something in our family, whatever it is, we need to know the infallible pilot in his presence as he steers the ship. And today I want to pray, and I want to lead us in the breaking of bread. As we do, I want you to thank him. I want you to take a moment before you take the breaking of bread as it comes around. You know the story. Please don't have unforgiveness in your heart. If you're a believer, join with us today. But if you have unforgiveness in your heart, sort it out. Sort it out. Do not take breaking of bread unless you've sorted it out. And then once you've sorted it out, take a moment and say, "Thank you for being the infallible pilot of my life." Yes. In the areas that I face storms, or that I will face storms into the future, I have faith and I trust in your presence as the infallible pilot of my life.